I'd still like to hear it. I'm sure you would, boy, but it's my story to tell, not yours to ask for. So, look around you. Are you satisfied? You found the magician's tomb, and but for a little light trick, it's empty. Josh looked at the shadow map again. The lines blurred, merging and separating in the slight breeze, creating a second layout that looked quite different from the first. Those were the lines he tried to focus on, because they offered a map quite unlike the one he carried in his pocket. Was it a trick of the wind, or his first proper glimpse of Glasstown? "How do I find it?" he said, pointing at the shadow map. "Who says it's there to be found? You wouldn't be guarding this place if it wasn't." "Very true." Josh had a dozen follow-up questions. Everything from where is the door, if there was a door, and how did he open it, to why Damiola had made Glasstown in the first place, and why he was still protecting it after all these years, what the scorch marks on his map represented. But he didn't have the chance to ask any of them. The old man tilted his head, seeming to sniff the air, then turned to look back out toward the cemetery. "He knows you're here. This isn't good. Come here." He placed a grubby hand on the center of Josh's chest. "Can you feel it? The disturbance in the night air? Not good. You frightened him. That's not a good thing. A man like Seth Lockwood doesn't react well to being scared. He's like a cornered beast. He reveals his claws." Josh heard the movement then, a scraping of feet dragging through the gravel chips that made up the pathways between the graves outside. "There's something out there." Not someone, something. The old tramp had chosen his words with care. "We can't stay here. This isn't where we make a last stand. And that's what's going to happen if we don't go now."
Cadmus Damiola snuffed out the flame that burned atop his sarcophagus, taking with it the shadow map, and hurried back toward the door, ushering Josh ahead of him. He stepped out into the night and saw the weird light immediately. Something. Like the apparition of Myrna Shepherd that had torn Boone's house apart looking for something.
"This way, hurry,"
the old man said, pulling at his sleeve. Josh turned his back on the ghostly glow and followed Damiola out through the iron gates. Damiola drew them closed behind him, dragging the left side back on a broken hinge that left it hanging preciously, then uttered a short declarative Josh didn't catch. The words refused to settle in his mind, squirming around like the metal itself did as Damiola passed a hand across the filigree. As with the door of the tomb itself, the rusted iron answered his touch with a ripple of flame, this one so hot it seemed to buckle and bow the metal to its whim. Josh saw the shapes of the birds wrought within the fretwork twist slowly as the birds began to tear free. Damiola leaned in, exhaling a single sharp breath into the iron beaks of the miraculous birds, and then stepped back, giving the summoning room to complete itself. It wasn't quiet. The shrieks of twisting metal shearing free of its welds drew an answering cry from the direction of the light. It was the sound of magic calling to magic, and it was as old as nature itself. Slowly at first, but with ever more determination, the raven's rusted wings pulled away from the frame. It twisted its head to peer at its master, with beady, rust-pitted eyes, the rhythmic womp-womp beat of its wings almost masking the shearing snaps of the final welds that pinned it to the gate. And then the metal raven took to the air, circling once, twice, three times overhead, impossible and magnificent as it trailed the rocket's red glow of sparks in its wake. The old man leveled a finger in the direction of the eerie light and whispered another impossible to concentrate on command, his words lost in the squeal of rusted metal as the raven swooped low, skimming the tops of the weathered stones, before chasing away toward the light reaching the edge of the cemetery, just as two men shuffle-walked into the Garden of the Dead. The light couldn't separate the pair. Josh didn't recognize them, except there was something vaguely familiar about them. He didn't have time to dwell on it. The squeals of metal transformed into shrieks as the raven fell upon the men, who in turn threw up their hands to defend themselves.
That should buy us some time.
How?
Not enough to stand here explaining that, or arguing about what we do next,
the old tramp said, breathing hard. Beads of sweat peppered his forehead and ran down the red vines in his cheeks to tangle in the mass of his scruffy beard. He started to run, barking short staccato sentences in front of him as he did.
You want into Glasstown? You need to pierce the veil between worlds to find a place of weakness, an oblique.
A what?
A weakness in the veil between worlds, where one brushes up against the other. You want to find a way into limbo, into hell, whatever you want to call it. You need to find a weakness. It is out of time. There is no secret door. I'm sorry.
You're wrong, Josh shouted at his back.
You must be. There has to be a door. I saw her. Eleanor. She was out here.
That stopped Damiola cold.
What are you saying?
I saw her.
No, that's impossible.
Like everything else you're talking about? Like flying metal birds and you being 120 years old?
Yeah, it's impossible,
Josh said bluntly.
Glasstown doesn't work like that. What we did, you can't just slip into and out of the other world. It's out of phase with our own. Time is different there. You can't walk from one to the other and back again. So whatever you think you saw, you couldn't have. And you need to pray for all of our sakes that you didn't,
he added, making the sign of the cross over his chest.
Even a crack in one of the lenses would be enough to doom it and everyone inside it. Once time slips in through the cracks, it all comes undone. It's entropy. It cannot hold.
Behind them they heard the desperate howl. It could not have been further from a core. It was an utterly broken sound, as the bird was ripped from beak to bowels, its shattered wings discarded by the duo, as they lunged between the broken stones, on the hunt.
What do I do? Easy. You run, and you hope those things don't get through me, because I'm all that's standing between you and them.
He reached into the folds of his coat for something stuffed deep in the pockets, and pulled out a small brass compact.
Sometimes the only way you can see through smoke and mirrors is with more smoke and better mirrors. Maybe it's time the whole thing came undone. Every trick runs its course. Look for my workshop on Cobb Street, over in Spitalfields. Everything you need is there. But know this, the closer you get, the more certain it is that Lockwood will kill you. Not just try.
He pressed the compact into Josh's hands and closed his own hands around them.
Don't slow down. Don't look back. Just run and keep on running, boy. Unless you want to die. Then by all means stick around here and let Lockwood's gets do it for you.
Josh saw the pair push their way awkwardly between gravestones, seeming to flicker in and out of focus as they came. He recognized them now. Al Klemp and Marty Craik, the comedy duo, and realized he'd seen them earlier that day. He'd been wrong. They weren't fancy-dress partygoers wearing rubber masks, and they weren't tied together for some bizarre three-legged charity collection. There was no bucket full of coins between them. They were conjoined, fused together.
What do I do?
Josh repeated, unable to tear his eyes away from the grotesque comedians as they lumbered toward him.
I've already told you!
Damiola barked and shoved Josh away. Josh didn't need telling a third time. He ran. 23. Mirror Kingdom. And he didn't stop running until the shockwave of the explosion hit him. so hard it flung him from his feet, with all the force of a punishing fist to the solar plexus. Josh scrambled back to his feet, looking back over his shoulder at the plume of black smoke and licks of flame coming from the heart of the old cemetery. A few lights came on around him, with faces appearing at the windows a moment later. From where they were, it must have looked like a gas explosion. Not that many years ago, the default fear would have been an IRA bomb. But times had changed. London wasn't the city it had been. Of course, now there were other terrors. But that first reaction to an explosion and fire wasn't a bomb these days. Even after the July 7 attacks, there was always another reason. He saw them coming out of the smoke, the comedians. There was no sign of the tramp, which could only mean one thing. They'd found a way past him. Josh felt the sting of gravel on his hands as he dusted them off on his jeans. For a full 10 seconds he stood, stock still, staring at the deformed duo as they shuffle-walked toward him, the smoke billowing all around them. Then he remembered what they were. Lockwood's henchmen. Just like the actress. He turned his back on them and ran. Instinct took him through the East End streets, those narrow warrens where once upon a time Jack the Ripper and Spring-Heeled Jack might have stalked, toward the bright new towers of the business district and Cop Street. They were gaining ground fast. He didn't know this part of the city half as well as he would have needed to if he wanted to plan any sort of escape route. Instead, he had to rely upon speed and luck and hope he didn't run himself down a blind alley. Josh drove himself on, not letting himself think. It was easier to run when you were terrified. The adrenaline flooded his system and cheated his mind into thinking he could run forever. Rain and sweat plastered his hair flat to his scalp. There were plenty of narrow little side streets and back alleys in this part of London. Josh gritted his teeth and took a left, then ducked right down a narrow lane that cut a channel between an old haberdashery shop and a newsagent's. He could hear the comedians coming, their static howls and slapping palms mocking him every step of the way. Josh doubled back on himself, realizing that he couldn't simply shake their pursuit. He needed to be smart, assuming they were somehow locked onto his scent. He needed to search out places that would mask his fragrance, or at least hide it among crowds of others. He remembered an old line about dogs losing the scent in water, and for one crazy second thought about hurling himself into the Thames and making a swim for it. The urge didn't last long, given the fact that he couldn't actually swim. He saw the lights of a pub a couple of 100 yards away and ran for it. He didn't stop running as he pushed through the doors into the snug. A couple of old heads turned to see what all the commotion was, but he kept on running straight toward the back of the room, and the gold-painted hand pointing toward the gents. There were perhaps 20 people in the room. Not enough to hide away in, but the place stank of stale beer and cigarettes, despite the smoking ban, and all the pervading smell of old sweat. It reeked. But would it be strong enough to buy him the time to put some real distance between himself and the relentless comedians? Probably not, he thought fatalistically. Not for the first time in the last 24 hours, he wished he had learned how to steal a car. It was pretty much a remedial skill for a kid raised on the Rothery, and if he lived long enough, it was a gap in his education he intended to plug. Someone laughed, seeing his panicked left-right-left look before his gaze fixed on the painted hand, assuming he was about to shit himself, which wasn't entirely wrong. Josh dodged around a man balancing 3 pints in stretched fingers, and pushed straight through the door, praying that he wasn't running himself into a literal dead end. On the other side he was confronted by 3 possible escape routes, and used the threadbare carpet to make his choice, taking the least walked alternative, gambling it would take him to the fire exit. He guessed right. At the end of the passageway he hit the safety bar on the door, triggering the alarm, and ran out into the yard behind the pub. The rain had eased off a little over the last few minutes, the worst of the storm having passed. The yard was filled with beer barrels. The rain played them like a Jamaican steel band. 6 concrete steps led down into the yard. Graffiti on the wall promised that God lived at the bottom of a pint of beer, and suggested the trick to finding him was as simple as drinking enough. Josh ran straight at the gate. It was bolted. Rather than open it, he clambered up onto one of the barrels, teetering awkwardly as it threatened to roll away from under him, and launched himself at the fence. He kicked, scrambling up over the top. It wasn't graceful, but it was effective, and dropped down into the alleyway on the other side. He hit the ground hard and kept on running. The alleyway was lined with green plastic wheelie bins and black sacks waiting for the dustbinmen to collect them. A stray dog curled up against the brick wall behind a restaurant, obviously familiar enough with the routines to know when the spoils were cast out. It saw him, but didn't stir itself. Josh paused twice to get his bearings as he reached an alternative junction or alley end, and was forced between taking a right or left or running straight on, not knowing where either eventually led. Hearing the suddenly shrill chorus of starlings again, he looked up at the sky. The birds banked and swirled, and once more he seemed to be beneath the epicenter of their mad flight. Unintentionally, his random twists and turns brought him back to the alley Eleanor Raines had disappeared down. He saw the sign on the wall, Cobb Street. He stopped running and looked back over his shoulder. The street was empty, but he could hear them, the manic slap, slap, slap of their hands on the brick houses, and the constant chatter of sharp teeth chomping mercilessly at his heels. They were coming for him. There was something completely off about the street. It felt like it belonged in another time, which it did, but he wasn't to know that. Cobb Street was long gone from any modern map of London, replaced by the concrete and steel office blocks and the great sprawl of the indoor market. He rushed down the street with the comedians on his heels. Now that he was on their turf, Clamp and Crake didn't rush to catch him. They didn't need to. Rather, they kept their measured pace. Shuffle, shuffle, drag. Shuffle, shuffle, drag. Knowing that he would inevitably tire, and when he did, they would fall upon him, bringing him down when he was at his weakest from what felt like hours of running. Smoke and mirrors. The word stuck in his head as he ran down Cobb Street. The entire thing was an illusion, a grand trick. Cadmus Damiola was a stage magician, after all. So wasn't whatever he'd done to Glasstown just some magnification of his magician's art? Like the Iron Raven, Josh thought, casting another backward glance, but this time looking over the comedians' heads. There was no sign of the magical construction in the sky, but if he was right, if it was just a trick, then what trick had Eleanor pulled on him to mask her disappearance? He turned over every stone in the alleyway, so how could she simply disappear into thin air? There was nothing that looked even remotely like a workshop on the street. There were flats with bricked-up windows, others with curtains drawn for the night. Some were so narrow it seemed impossible to imagine people called them home. Smoke and mirrors.
Sometimes the only way you can see through smoke and mirrors is with more smoke and better mirrors.
That's what he had now, didn't he? A better mirror. Josh fished the compact from his pocket and fumbled with the clasp, well aware that the comedians watched him from the other end of the alleyway. Facing away from them, Josh held up the compact and looked in the mirror, not sure what he expected to happen, if the magician's mirror would suddenly give him new eyes, or at least some new sharper perception, or if he would simply see some backward landscape in which the comedians lumbered toward him in miniature. There was a blue moon behind them, or a blue-tinged streetlight, that cast their end of the alleyway in its peculiar ghost-light, just as there had been with the actress in Boone's house. But beyond that, there was an almost ethereal quality about them, as though the light somehow passed through them rather than around them. It was only a slight difference, but it changed everything. Smoke and better mirrors. But that wasn't the only thing that caught his eye as being wrong about the reflection. But he couldn't know for sure without turning around to face the comedians. He was right. There, amid the run-down backs of the Victorian terrace, was a door. A split stable door with the words, Goods Entrance, engraved in an arc across the lintel. There was a symbol beneath it, a Celtic knot around a leafless tree, branded into the door. It had to be the entrance to Damiola's workshop, because there wasn't a door there unless he looked for it in the mirror's glass. Face front, the walls and windows seamlessly joined, hiding its existence. Was this a first glimpse of how the magician had hidden away Glasstown, a prototype for the trick on a much smaller scale? There was no denying the fact the door wasn't there, and then it was when he looked at the street through the looking glass, only for it to disappear again when the mirror was removed from the equation. The magician's workshop was hidden in plain sight. If anyone would know the workings of that kind of trick, it would be the man whose signature illusion, the Opticron, involved the manipulation of light and sight through lenses, wouldn't it? Josh took four steps back toward the mouth of Cobb Street and the comedians, then reached out with his free hand to fumble with the door. It was difficult doing everything in reverse, but after a couple of seconds of groping around, he opened the door. As the door swung outward, the comedians entered Cobb Street. Close up, there was nothing funny about them. The fat man inclined his head slightly, seeming to sniff the air. Just like a dog, Josh thought, amending that quickly to a rabid one. There was no streetlight or shop sign or any other possible source for the weird blue-tinged light now. It emanated from within the fat man, Al Clamp. Only, of course, it wasn't the comedian, dead ringer for him or not. That thing in the alleyway was something else entirely, like the woman last night. They were a pair. Both of them burned with the same weird light, as if they were being projected into the streets by some godlike cine camera. The comedians shuffled a step toward him. Just the one. They didn't move comfortably. Marty Craik's mouth twitched. What frightened Josh more than anything was that somehow he was close enough to see that involuntary muscle spasm. The calls of the starlings were the only sound in the otherwise silent alleyway. Al Clamp's gaze seemed to drift upward, drawn to the raucous birds. There was no iron raven up there to save Josh this time. The reed-thin Marty Craik came toward him, moving with an uncanny serpentine grace. Josh saw the way his hand was fused together with his companion's, the pair conjoined at hand and hip. Josh couldn't seem to force his body to turn, though his mind screamed, "Run!" His legs stubbornly refused to obey him. That one step over the threshold into the workshop was beyond him. And then Marty Craik's mouth opened wider than ought to have been possible, and wider still as his jawbone dislocated with a shocking snap. The comedian's lips stretched back on row after row of razor-sharp teeth as his smile transformed into a death's head rictus. Beside him, Al Clamp loosed a shrill static shriek. Windows overhead cracked. Then, as the shriek escalated, shattered, showering biting sharp shards of glass down on Cobb Street. Josh clamped his hands over his ears, the paralysis that had gripped him broken finally, and nearly fell through the doorway as his soles lost their purchase on the slick cobbles. He reached out with his right hand, planting it flat on the side of the frame, and plunged into the darkness of Damiola's workshop. They came after him, no hint of shambling or shuffling movement as they surged down the middle of the narrow street, their outstretched hands slapping against the brick walls and wooden fences on either side, playing them like the leather skins of battle drums as they ran. If the wild drumming was meant to intimidate him, it worked, but not half as effectively as Clamp's unearthly static howl. That was so much worse. It was like a jolt of electricity pulsing through his blood. Every muscle tensed as it surged through him. That noise removed any and all doubt that the comedians were fashioned from the same stuff as Myrna Shepherd, and that their sole purpose was to tear his soul apart. He slammed the door behind him, praying it would keep them out. Damiola's workshop was an incredibly narrow building, claustrophobic and cobwebbed, with only two rooms on the ground floor. The bare boards of a staircase rose at the far end of the uncarpeted hallway. With very little light, he mistook the mirrors at the end of the hallway for windows out into the street beyond. If he'd have looked more closely, or thought about the fact there was no light source in the workshop, he might have seen that the light was emanating from within the mirrors, and the landscapes he saw there bore no relation to what he should have been seeing through the window of an East End hovel, but rather looked to be perfect reflection of a greener, pleasanter land. Albion. The ancient England was surrounded by mirrors filled with mist. But fear stopped him from seeing any of that. The first of the two ground-floor rooms must have been the magician's workroom once upon a time. It was filled with the dusty accoutrement of his art. Sword cabinets stood empty, housing dust and spiders in place of a crisscross of deadly blades. Elaborate water-torture chambers, long since drained dry. Chains and handcuffs dangled from the ceiling, suspended on hooks where Damiola must have practiced his escapologist's act. The mirrors of a crude Pepper's ghost trick, lined up to cast his mirror image halfway across the room, all half hidden in shadow. Trapdoor mechanisms, hidden compartment triggers, all manner of curious contraptions and installations that simulated levitation and other illusions. Linking rings lay on a worktop. A death saw cabinet lay folded in two, no beautiful assistant's feet wiggling out of it, and so much more he couldn't describe, much less imagine how they might function on stage. It was all here, every part of the magician's craft. But it was all broken, unmade, or at least part-made. These weren't the finished articles. These were tricks in various stages of the design process. He moved through them quickly, looking for something, but with no idea what that something might be. The second room was given over to the three glassblowers' ovens, the furnace, the glory hole, and the annealer, and the blowpipes, plaster, wooden molds, crucibles, and the rails that had been set up for the pipes to ride, so the magician could shape the glass while it was still red-hot. There were hand-drawn designs on the scarred and pitted workbench. Josh looked at them as he moved through the room, assuming they were the blueprints for the Opticron, or some variation of the light manipulation illusion he'd been working on before he made his deal with the devil that was Seth Lockwood. A large marble slab dominated the rest of the room, which was where the magician did his work. The floorboards were stained with burns and scorch marks. Around the room were other glass objects. A vast array of lenses and the like surrounded the blueprints on the bench. Component parts of the Opticron, no doubt. Spare parts or misfires. It was impossible to say which. Josh stepped over a pair of jacks that lay discarded on the floor. It had obviously been decades since the furnaces were last fired up. A thick layer of dust and grime had settled over everything. It all smelled so stale, like the air hadn't moved in the workshop for years. The front door rattled against its frame, dragging him back to the here and now abruptly. There was no back door. That was his first thought. There were windows in the hall, and here in the workrooms, and plenty of things to break them with. Josh had to fight down the urge to panic. He needed to think. Be calm. But he felt sick. Through the window in the magician's workshop, virtually opaque from the build-up of soot and muck clinging to it, he could see the rusty metal rungs of a fire escape descending from the roof, meaning there had to be a way out from the floor above that didn't involve trying to clamber out through wire-reinforced windows with the comedian snapping at his heels. The only way is up, he thought grimly, running for the stairs. Even as he reached them, he threw a glance toward the array of mirrors, finally grasping the fact that they weren't reflecting the workshop, but not understanding their true nature as he climbed the stairs to the next landing. The slam of fists against the outside door chased him, pounding over and over until the wood splintered beneath the impact. Josh had seconds at best to get out of there. At worst, it was already too late, and two doors to choose from. Eenie and Meenie, with neither looking more like salvation than the other. He followed the geography of the house in his mind's eye and grabbed the knob of the second, yanking open the door directly above the glass room. He stepped into the room as the comedians burst into the workshop, and was confronted by what appeared to be an enormous Heath Robinson contraption, some crazy juxtaposition of junk. There was a brass steam boiler heated by tiny kettles that vented steam that hit a brass plate above and condensed, only to pool in the pan and be dripped back into the kettles to boil again and again, thus creating the machine's own tiny ecosystem that turned the gears and complex pulley arrangements that were threaded by lengths of knotted string, manipulating a huge lens in the center of the room. There were mirrors, too, a bank of them with gilt-edged frames and foil-speckled glass where the silvering had worn away. Two contained absolutely no reflections at all, the thin light passing into them, but reflecting nothing back out. Two others offered a glimpse of deserted streets and what looked like the false fronts of a film set. Josh realized he was seeing Glasstown for the first time, but didn't have the luxury of time to appreciate just how incredible that was. He looked around for something he could use to defend himself. Anything. Anything at all. There was an old Imperial typewriter, which appeared to have a page from a manuscript still in the carriage. Beside it, there was an old cine camera on a wooden platform. None of the component parts of the contraption appeared to bear any relation to any of the others. None had any obviously apparent use. It was like the whole thing had been cobbled together to confound the eye, like an elaborate game of mousetrap. So many of the pieces appeared to be held together by duct tape and a prayer. But it worked. The reels whirred, and Josh saw that a film was threaded into the projector, so that it spooled from one reel to another, and then onto a third, which fed it back to the first reel, ensuring the film never played out. The camera's light was aimed right at the heart of the huge lens in the middle of the mechanism, and shone out through the room's only window, as if projecting a new reality out there. Josh didn't have time to wonder what trick he'd stumbled onto. He heard the comedian's static shrieks taunting him as they dragged their twisted body up the stairs. It came again, like broken laughter. It was hideous. Josh worked his way around the side of the room, having to squeeze between prongs that jutted out of the contraption and the wall, making his way over to the window. He could see the iron fire escape on the other side of the glass, but when he tried to open the window, it refused to budge. The sash had been nailed shut. The comedians appeared in the doorway. Marty Craik's red raw gums peeled back on row upon row of teeth. There was no room on his face for anything else. Teeth, teeth, teeth. Teeth slick with spittle, teeth clogged with gristle. Teeth filed to points, fashioned to rend and tear flesh. White noise burst from his hideous mouth. Josh tugged desperately at the window, but it wasn't opening. Damiola had told him what he needed to do, he realized then. And it wasn't run. 24. The Soulless City. He clawed at one of the nails, desperately trying to pry it free, but it wasn't moving. Splinters dug into his fingertips. He could see Clamp and Craik's reflections weirdly distorted in the hand-blown glass, and yet the reflections were somehow less horrific than the reality they offered as they came into the room. The pulley, cog, and camera contraption occupied so much of the floor space they couldn't easily get to him. Josh made sure to keep it that way for as long as he could, realizing quickly that the comedians seemed reticent to so much as touch the machine. He edged away from the window, keeping as much of the contraption between him and them as they worked their way around the room. Another ghost shriek of static crackled out of the fat one's mouth. It seemed almost as though there were words trapped in there, trying desperately to be heard. Craig's rows of teeth chattered. The white noise kept coming, along with it more and more snatches of something else, something so close to words, but not quite, that they sounded all the more sinister for the almost familiarity. Josh backed away from the pair, taking one shuffling step for every one of theirs. He could almost imagine them going around and around in circles, the Heath Robinson machine between them forever. Only that couldn't happen. They might not tire, but he most certainly would. And when he did, well, looking at those teeth, what happened after that was the last thing he wanted to imagine. He felt the sweat beginning to gather clammily against his skin.
"What do you want from me?"
Josh asked. Al Clamp answered that with a grin, his fat face looking anything but threatening, as he followed his hungry companion around the side of the machine, in that eerie knot silence that shrouded them. Every time his foot came down on one of the bare floorboards, Instead of being greeted by a creak or groan, it was met by a burst of static and a surge of white noise that lanced through him, the filings in his teeth resonating sympathetically, so they functioned as a receiver inside his head, amplifying the noise through the bones of his skull. It was hell. Josh caught one of the armatures dangling over the side of the contraption with his hip. It swung inward. A dozen other pieces of the peculiar device rattled and clanged, adding to the tinnitus wailing inside his head. The projection light veered upward as the platform supporting the cine camera tilted alarmingly, and, the effects being felt along the many joints and joists of the contraption, the lens began to oscillate. A weird humming emanated from the glass, barely audible above the sheer hateful sound of the white noise.
"Even a crack in one of the lenses would be enough to doom it and everyone inside it."
Damiola had told him how to win this fight, even if he hadn't intended to. One of the comedian's two heads seemed to say, while the lizard-like tongue of the others flicked along the ridges of his teeth, making a show of just how hungry he was. Spittle clung to the yellowed points. The fat man tried to wriggle his girth through a tight gap, reaching out for Josh. After that first question, Josh hadn't said a word, so the comedian had to be shushing the contraption, which made it all the creepier. Josh edged another step back toward the door and the landing. The fat man seemed to realize what Josh was doing. He shook his head and stopped trying to push his way through a gap that wasn't there, and moved back toward the door. Craig's face, full of teeth, gnashed, rose grinding against each other as he chewed through another static howl. This time the sound was enough to drive Josh to his knees, as the plates of his skull threatened to tear apart. He clutched at his head. Then, as his head went down, began to beat at his temples with the heels of his hands, trying to drive the torments out. When he finally looked up, the comedians were barely an arm's length away. Josh struggled to rise, placing one of his hands on the brass boiler. He recoiled, wincing as the metal burned his palm. But instead of fighting it, forced himself to put both hands on the searing plates and pushed with all of his might. The rickety contraption concertinaed in on itself like a collapsing house of cards, though for one alarming second, the lens seemed to stay suspended in midair before it finally fell. The kettle spilled steaming water across the bare floorboards. The duct-taped armatures pulled apart, buckling as one end tore free of the other, and the entire thing came tumbling down. The lens hit the floor. One of the small kettles hit the lens, cracking it right through its convex heart. The light from the cine camera stuttered and failed. As it went out, the static howls of the comedians reached a crescendo, shattering every piece of glass in the room. The cold wind howled in, bringing with it driving rain. Josh didn't dare look away from Crake and Clamp. The fat half of the duo moved forward, feet crunching through the debris. Those huge jaws opened again impossibly wide, as the comedian's jawbone dislocated with a crack and continued to open to the point where it could have swallowed Josh's head whole. There was no answering howl, only silence this time. Profound, horrifying silence. It was so much worse than the static. His partner in crime grabbed hold of one wooden spur and yanked it free. He ripped the old Imperial typewriter free from the twisted wreckage and hurled it at Josh. He barely managed to get out of the way as the huge lump of metal sailed out through the shattered window behind him. Josh felt the sudden surge of fresh air against his scalp and didn't hesitate. He turned and hurled himself out through the shattered window right after the typewriter, hitting the iron floor of the fire escape on his hands and knees. His momentum carried him into the safety railings. Shards of broken glass cut into his hands as he pushed himself up to his feet. He risked a look back into the room and wished he hadn't. The deformed comedians were slowed by the debris, but not stopped by it. Coming out of the stuffy old narrow house, the air felt painfully fresh in his lungs as he gulped it down. The rain hit his face. He didn't know which way to turn. He looked up at the sky. The birds were gone. The sky was gray and full of soot and coal dust that hung over the rooftops in a cloud of man-made fog. Through the clouds, Josh saw the lights of the stars. The constellations shifted, trailing light like an entire heaven filled with shooting stars. For a moment, it looked as though every single star was raining down from the sky, somehow holding their alignments and patterns until they settled in a different part of the sky. Josh stood there for the longest time, gazing up at a different sky, until the crashes as the comedians hurled pieces of the contraption aside to get to the window spurred him into motion. The metal stairs were rain-slick and treacherous. Josh grabbed the iron handrail and clanged down the steps toward the ground as fast as he dared, setting foot in Glasstown without even realizing he'd stumbled upon it. The woman with the red umbrella, Eleanor, waited at the foot of the fire escape, looking up at him, a look of absolute horror on her beautiful face. 25. Glasstown.
"That can't be here,"
she said, even before he'd reached the ground. She wasn't talking about him. She was looking up over his shoulder at the broken window of Damiola's workshop, where the comedians were framed by rotten timber and jags of broken glass. She didn't seem the least bit disturbed by the thing's appearance, taking the endless teeth and wide, wide mouth in her stride, like it was something she saw every day in this place.
"It can't be here. It just can't. There's no crack. It can't just walk into this place."
And then the horror as realization hit her.
"Unless, please God, tell me you didn't break the anchor."
She grabbed Josh by the arm and all but dragged him the last two stairs down to the ground. He didn't know what to say. He'd expected her to be thrilled to see him. Hadn't she just begged him in lipstick on the wall to find her? Hadn't his family been searching for her for the best part of 90 years, never giving up in all that time, and he'd found her? He'd imagined her throwing herself into his arms and, well, if not exactly showering him with kisses, at least treating him like a conquering hero.
"Listen to me, please. You have to get out of here. Now. Go, before it tears the whole place apart."
Which was easy to say. But there was no way he was going back up that fire escape when that thing was waiting for him at the top.
"Eleanor, it is you, isn't it?"
Josh said.
"Yes, yes, it's me. You found me. Clever boy. But if you're going to stand there wanting a pat on the back, I wish you hadn't. Not with that thing hunting you. You have no idea what you've done, breaking the anchor, leading that thing in here. Now, please, no arguments. You have to go."
She dragged him away from the fire escape toward the end of the alleyway. He could see the green metal dome of what looked like an old theater, the copper completely tarnished. There was a small railed-off garden in the square, and a stone fountain in the center. The trees were trapped in perpetual autumn, the leaves forever browned and curled, but not yet fallen from the bough. That almost stopped Josh there and then. He'd climbed out of a wet winter window into an autumnal street. He felt his grip on the simple things, like where he was, slip along with those stars in the sky above them.
"Oh, God, Seth's going to know you've been in here. You need to fix the anchor. Get that thing as far away from here as you can, and fix Damiola's infernal machine, before the broken glass scars the place beyond all recognition."
The yard behind the magician's workshop was clean, unlike any of the others he'd run down in his flight from the comedians. No wheelie bins, no black plastic sacks, or cardboard boxes, or anything like that. No litter on the cobbles at all. Not even a page of yesterday's news blowing down the street. It was an absolutely sterile environment, like the film set it had been once upon a time. Josh shook his head stupidly.
"Anchor? Scars? I don't understand."
"Look," she told him, pointing up at the window where the comedians were making an ungainly effort to climb out onto the fire escape. Craig's first foot clattered on the iron platform. The sound seemed to ripple down to them through the fire escape into the ground.
"Look at its hand. Look at what it's done to the wooden frame."
He did, though he didn't really understand what he was seeing. The window frame around the comedian's hand appeared to be blistering. Curls of smoke peeled away from the timber. It was as if he were watching a piece of film burn under the heat of the camera's light, the frame around it shriveling back to pure white light. When the comedian's first foot came through the window and set down on the iron fire escape, the contact burned up another precious few inches, scarring the world. It was only one tiny part of Glasstown, but it had only been on this side of the illusion for a few seconds, and in that time the first blister had popped, revealing nothing beneath it. A negative, an empty space.
What's happening? That thing is one of my keepers. Seth calls them reels. It's a joke. He's got other pets. Dailies, rushes, negatives. They're all part of the film world he stole me from. It's not human. I don't know what it is. A demon, maybe, if you believe in them. A creature of the mists. A devil. Any of them work. I don't know how Seth controls it. What kind of pact he made with Damiola to take possession of the damned things. Or if he just killed the magician and took them for his own. But he owns that thing and all of the others like it. Body and lack of soul.
She crossed herself as she said this. Josh couldn't help but think that whatever was going on, it was well outside the help of any god, no matter how strong her faith.
And you being here, you are a threat to this place. It won't stop until you are dead and the threat is gone.
I'm no threat.
You're here. You're Isaiah Rains's blood. You're the first person to set foot inside the confines of this damned prison of mine. That makes you more of a threat to him than any of your family has ever been. There's a weakness, a crack. He doesn't think I know about it. I'll take you there. Come on.
She grabbed his hand and dragged Josh toward the gate in the garden rails and through it, urging him to hurry as they rounded the fountain. It was only as he passed it, he noticed that the nymph in the centerpiece had Eleanor's face. It was disconcerting, to say the least, a glimpse as to the depths of Seth Lockwood's obsession with the actress. Josh didn't get to dwell on the realization. Eleanor kept on running until they were out the other side of the small garden and standing in the middle of an empty street. She looked at him then, seeming to see him properly for the first time.
Are you Boone's son?
Grandson.
Already? So much time has gone. You look so very like him.
Boone.
Isaiah. You could be his body double. It's uncanny. I feel like I am face to face with his ghost. I just...
She reached out to touch his face, but stopped short and shook her head.
We don't have time for this. As much as I want to talk, to tell you things, Seth set that thing after you. It's a hunter. You've got to go. Please, get as far away from here as you can. It's the only way you'll stand a chance.
He knew she was right. He had brought this thing here. But in his defense, he didn't know where here was, or what it was he'd brought with him. Damiola hadn't told him any of it beyond setting him down in the right direction. The only thing he said, really, was that even a crack in the glass would be enough to ruin the delicate balance his creation held in place, manipulating the veil between worlds. He hadn't told him to break that glass back there. He hadn't said tear down the fabric of the illusion, or begged him to set the truth free. He hadn't even meant to tell him what the anchors were, but he had a map, the location of each one seared onto it, and he had a mirror to see through the smoke hiding them.
"I only just found you!"
The objection sounded lame the moment it left his mouth, but he carried on, sounding like a child.
"You wanted me to find you. You wrote that on the wall, didn't you? Find me. That was you, wasn't it?"
"Yes, it was me. You know it was. But I didn't know you were a marked man. I had no idea he'd set the reels on you. Believe me, if I had, I never would have dragged you into this. I'd have stayed hidden. I'm very good at it. I've been doing it for a long time. And, Jesus, just to be blunt for a moment, you weren't supposed to just walk in here. No one has been able to do that since Damiola's duomas sealed the film studio set away. Do you have any idea what you've done? If he finds you here, He'll know the anchors are coming loose.
She shook her head.
There's no telling what he'll do then. He's not like normal people. He doesn't like losing. He'd rather destroy the board than lose the game.
That was a telling glimpse into Seth Lockwood's psychology. Eleanor pulled on his arm again, forcing Josh to match her speed, as she started to run through empty streets of Glasstown toward the crack that would lead him back through to the streets of London on the other side of the illusion. He used every second he spent in the place to soak it in. Every building, every window, every streetlight, gaslight, he realized, every car, none of them immediately recognizable, the badges naming them ABCs and Crosleys and other bygone models. It really was like walking through a fully dressed, completely deserted film set masquerading as 1920s London. It didn't feel real. All the details were there, but it was like there was nothing behind their painted fronts. There was a factory, he saw, but no smoke rising from any of its chimneys, and a public house, but no welcoming light burning inside its taproom. He looked back over his shoulder several times to see the comedians following them, and behind the grotesque Crake and Clamp, a trail of silver footprints that smoldered and blistered a path all the way back to the magician's workshop. Josh had no idea how she could possibly hope to hide them from Seth or anyone else. Black curls of smoke rose from them, crying out, "Here! Look at us! See us! We are wrong! We shouldn't be here!" Then, through the smoke, he noticed something else. A shadow shape, a blur of movement. He tried to focus on it, but there was something decidedly wrong about the way it moved. He heard its claws on the street, scrabbling as the shape raced toward him. Josh couldn't bring it into focus. Eleanor grabbed his arm and dragged him down another empty street, and then another, constantly looking back over her shoulder as the animal surged toward them, its powerful gait eating the distance between them too quickly for comfort. Glasstown was a vast, empty townscape, but that meant there was no one to stop them, as Eleanor dragged him into a house and slammed the door behind them, and kept on running out the other side, through another house and another. Contrary to his first impression, every interior was immaculate, frozen in time. He saw frames of everyday people and their everyday lives locked in place. Everything just so, from the china on the table to the cutlery and even the coats hanging over the banisters. He didn't stop to think what the presence of all this stuff meant. He just followed Eleanor. Finally, she stopped running, having led them into a dead end. They faced the brick wall. Josh looked back over his shoulder to see the comedians approaching, the hound at their heels. While it moved like a dog, snapping and snarling rapidly but soundlessly at the air, it possessed a haunting X-ray-like quality of a photographic negative. The dark patches of fur were painfully bright, its eyes two bright white spheres that blazed demonically.
"There,"
Eleanor said, pointing at nothing.
"What is that thing?"
Josh said, unable to tear his eyes off the animal stalking toward him.
"Seth calls it a negative. There are three of them. I call them hellhounds, black dogs. They keep me in this place. It's grotesque, like so much else that Seth Lockwood lays his hand to. Now go, before you can't. Through there."
Josh saw a shadow that ran like a crack at the juncture of the red brick wall and the house it butted onto.
"It's a weakness in the veil. You can slip through, back into your own London. Go. Close your eyes if it helps."
Josh looked back over his shoulder one last time. The comedians were no more than 200 feet away, but the dog was so much closer. 80 feet and closing fast, less than 5 seconds from pouncing on him. They weren't going to have the luxury of some long farewell.
"Come with me." "I can't. It doesn't work like that." "Of course it does. Just take my hand. I've seen you out there." "I can't leave this place, not for more than a few minutes. You'll see why when you leave. Now go."
"What about the—"
He didn't get to finish asking how she'd deal with the smoldering tracks of the comedians or the rabid negative. She didn't even ask him what his name was. Eleanor shoved Josh toward the shadow, and he found himself falling into it. There was a moment, a singular moment that existed within the silence between his heartbeats, when there was nothing. It was the most frightening thing Josh had experienced in his life, despite lasting for less than a second. In that moment, his senses failed him. There was no sight, no sound. He could taste the saliva in his mouth, rusty with blood, but there was nothing to feel, not above or below or around him, and no lingering odors, not even his own sweat. Nothing. It all simply ceased to be. Was this what death was like, an absence of everything? And then he heard her say,
"Save me,"
as he staggered out into the middle of a busy road, into the blaring of horns and the biting cold of the rain, the night and the stars gone, the sun high in the morning sky. His senses came alive as he stepped straight into the path of a police car. 26. Eternal Flame. Josh froze. That hesitation saved his life. Had he tried to run, the reflexes of the driver would have left him lying dead in the middle of the road. As it was, the man behind the wheel instinctively executed an evasive maneuver, slamming his foot down hard and yanking on the wheel that had the police car slewing sideways across the road, tires shrieking as they burned rubber. It spun past Josh as the comedians emerged from the shadows. They weren't so lucky. The sounds of the impact were sickening as the radiator buckled around their tangled legs, clamp thrown high into the air, even as Marty Craik's head came down, his face cannoning off the bonnet to a chorus of shattering teeth, before the pair were casually tossed aside by the momentum of the spinning car. The bodies cartwheeled across the white line, still seeming to hold hands to the horror of the witnesses, only to be caught by the front of a number 23 bus hurrying toward Aldwych. That second impact battered them beyond all recognition, as they hit the tarmac and were mangled beneath the relentless forward motion of the bus. It didn't matter how hard the driver stamped on the brakes. The bus was moving too fast, and the stopping distance too far to save the comedians from going under its speeding wheels. Someone screamed, thinking they were watching two men in fancy dress die. Josh still didn't move. He was staring at the shadow, waiting for the negative dog to emerge. When it didn't, he finally turned to look at the horror unfolding in the street. He watched as one of the comedian's arms flapped weakly. Cars stopped all around him, people running to help, others crying or dead silent in shock, him an island of absolute stillness inside the chaos of it all. People came out of the shops, passengers poured out of the bus, drivers opened car doors, all of them walking into the middle of the road, bringing the traffic to a stop. Every single one of them driven by morbid curiosity to see something they really didn't want to see. And still Josh didn't move. He heard someone yelling, barking orders at the others. He watched the bus driver stumble out of his seat, shaking his head, saying over and over,
"I didn't see them. I didn't see them. I couldn't stop. They came out of nowhere."
Someone else shouted,
"Don't try and move them! Don't! Just leave them!"
"We should do something!"
Voices, voices everywhere.
"We have to help them! Has someone called an ambulance?"
"Are they dead?"
"Do you think they're dead?"
"Oh, God! They're dead, aren't they? Jesus! Fuck! Jesus!"
And still Josh didn't move. He didn't move when the young policeman came across to him and tried to guide him out of the road.
"Are you all right, sir? Sir, are you okay? Can you hear me? Are you hurt?"
Nothing. Josh stared at a man sitting in the window of a cafe across the street. The light above him was dim, so he couldn't see his face properly, but he could see more than enough. It wasn't some mysterious newfound cousin. It was Seth Lockwood, the same youthful Seth he'd seen in number 13. Just like Eleanor, he hadn't aged a day in 90 years. On the table in front of Seth, there was what looked like some kind of glass orb, a lens of sorts, crusted in parts with dried blood. Until an hour ago, Josh wouldn't have thought there could be anything sinister about a glass ball. Now he knew better.